I want to say thank you to all the people who volunteered so far this year to help out the flood victims. It's just been amazing how our community has stepped up. We figure probably around 50% of the people here who call Friends Church their home have already volunteered. So if you haven't, I encourage you to reach out. Probably you have friends touched by this. Reach out and help somebody. 2 years ago, something amazing happened in Egypt. I'm not sure who saw this, but in the last, or the years leading up to this event, the Christian community in Egypt had been hit pretty hard. And when I say pretty hard, they had an event where they left the service and someone did a drive-by shooting and killed like 7 people. And then just the week before this happened, a suicide bomber had come into the community and killed, I think, 8 people, wounded another 70. So can you imagine if you're in a Christian community and church, where you come to kind of work on your spiritual journey, didn't feel safe? Where literally your life is at risk if you come to church. That's what was happening in the Egyptian community 2 years ago. It was tough because it was coming up to the end of the year, Christmas time, New Year's Eve, some big masses going on in there, some really important times for people. Do they go, connect with God, but risk their lives, or do they stay home? And so 2 years ago, I think it was New Year's Eve, the Christian community from Egypt started to walk towards their church. And as they got closer, something weird was happening. They realized there was people all around their church. And at first they couldn't tell what was going on. And then they realized that thousands of people from the Muslim community had come out to bring their physical bodies around the Christian church so that the Christian community could be able to go to church and be safe. Isn't that amazing? The Muslims said, if anything's going to happen, if any violence happens today, we're going to put our bodies between it and you guys so you can be safe. Talk about laying down your life for somebody else. When I read that story this week, I started to ask myself, would I be willing to do that? If I knew that there was somebody who could do harm to the Muslim community, would I go and put my body physically in the way of that harm so they could worship in a way that they grew up with? Would you? It's a powerful story, isn't it? And yet people can look at the Muslim community and those thousands of people there that day and say, ah, they don't get it. They're not doing it right. They're not following God. And yet the way of Jesus looks a lot like what they were doing, doesn't it? I'll come back to that. So, when I was young, my mom, she's a reader. My mom reads all the time. And she got in her head that she wanted us to be readers. And so at some point she read an article in some, I don't know what, that said if you read to your kids, they'll start to love reading and they'll be smarter. Not sure that it worked, but she went at this with a gusto. And I'm telling you, she read a ton to us. My whole growing up years, I remember in the evening we'd sit down on the couch, me and my brother and sister, and my mom would read chapter after chapter after chapter. Her voice would start to get hoarse. One of us would run and get her water, come back, keep reading, keep reading. She read us all, I think there's 20 Little House on the Prairie books. Do you know Laura Ingalls did that much? So like she gets married. Yeah, like there's a whole like drama about her. So she read all of those cover to cover, every book. She read us the E.B. White books, Stuart Little, Charlotte's Web. There's one about a little mouse. I couldn't remember the name of it. I called her. She couldn't remember either. But there's a little mouse that goes around and sees the world. And she read us the Narnia series. And that's just the few that she read. And while all the stories were wonderful and imaginative, even the Little House on the Prairie ones, the ones that really caught my attention are the Narnia series. I was blown away as a young child by this crazy world that this Christian theologian, C.S. Lewis, had built. From the first book, The Magician's Nephew, where the world's created, right through to the end where it kind of seems like the world's over. Just the whole thing, the way he wrote it, it just got me. Talking animals, like how cool is that? You're 8 years old, there's an animal that talks. A horse who hangs out with his buddy, you know, cool. Over the years, I started to read the books myself. I read them through again, then every couple years I read them through again. Then my mom found that the BBC had recorded radio plays of these things. So she bought all those for me and sent them to me, so I listened to them all again. I don't remember what exactly had happened. I think it was just before I went to seminary. I was reading one of the stories in the last book called The Last Battle that I had read, I don't know, probably at this point, a dozen times in my life. And I read a section that I'd read it before, but I never really thought about it. And at this point in my life, it's just like it just hit me. And this is, the fascinating thing is, this is from C.S. Lewis. From, in terms of modern day Christian theologians, he's a heavyweight. You know, he wrote Mere Christianity, Great Divorce, Screwtape Letters. He had shaped significantly Christian thought. And in his books, in the Narnia series, he writes this tale that just, it just blows my mind. So, welcome to Summer at Friend Church. It's always a bit quieter, although the band kicked it up today, didn't they? That was amazing. We're doing something a little bit different. We're doing a series called Spiritual Mentors. It's basically, we get to talk about people who shaped our lives, colored our spiritual journeys, in some way have impacted our spiritual journeys or Christian life. And today I want to talk about C.S. Lewis, or maybe not all of C.S. Lewis. I just want to talk about the writings of the Narnia series. So let me give you a little bit of background, because as I said, I talked to people about the Narnia series, and they said, well, yeah, I've seen the movies. There's like 2 movies out, isn't there? 3 movies? I'm way behind. So there's 7 books. I'm going to talk about the last one. So if you've seen the movies, you have no clue, but I'll give you a bit of a primer. You should read the books. Anyways, Narnia, there's a world called Narnia, and right next door is a world called Tarkan. And while Narnia worshipped the great lion Aslan, the Tarkans worshipped Tash. So I don't want to push the metaphor too far, but it kind of seems like this. Aslan is like God, Tash is like the devil. So, good, bad, all the kind of the same metaphors apply. And so after the failure of some religious leaders who tried to tell the world that Aslan and Tash were the same thing, C.S. Lewis places us in the world after the world. Maybe a little like some people's conception of heaven. And there we meet Emeth, a loyal Tarkin soldier who worshipped Tash his whole life. He was profoundly devout. But he's in Aslan's land. And he doesn't really know why he's there, because he's like, I was the enemy of Aslan. I worshipped Tash devoutly my whole life. Why am I in, for lack of a better word, heaven? And that's when he meets Aslan. And through the words C.S. Lewis puts into Aslan's mouth, he says a couple statements that really just fundamentally have shifted many things for me. And while I could read it with my growly little voice, I decided to use my mom's radio plays and give you guys a little taste of what it's going to sound like.
No one will come. What they truly seek.
It's a short little piece. When you think about it, he's saying some huge statements there, isn't he? Any good thing you do, no matter who you did it for, no matter where you did it, no matter why you did it, any good thing you do goes to Aslan. And any bad thing you do, that's for Tash. It doesn't matter which name you had in the beginning. It's the quality of the deed. The Muslims who used their bodies as physical shields so the Egyptian Christians could go there in safety. The Buddhist who donates to the Red Cross for flood relief. The atheist who buys his buddy a beer who's having a bad day. The Christian who calls a friend to say, I miss you. Every good thing anyone anywhere in the world does, no matter why they did it, is God's. It blew my mind. And if you flip it around, any bad thing, no matter how devout you say you are to God, no, it's not. The Sikh who oppresses their gay neighbor. Christian who is selfish with their time and money. The Hindu who hates instead of loves. Any bad thing, no matter how devout they say to God, they are to God, it's not God's. C.S. Lewis seems to be exploring a concept of God that is bigger than I had ever thought of. Bigger than my Sunday school teachers with their little flannel graphs that taught me all about God. Bigger than my systematic course in school. I even think bigger than the Bible. Bigger than religion. Bigger. In that one monologue, C.S. Lewis is challenging us to conceive of a God that is bigger than everything we know. Bigger than anything we thought about before. And in one breath, it's an exciting idea. And then about 2 seconds later, it's the most terrifying idea. Because the implications for this are huge, aren't they? Could God be bigger than everything we believe in Christianity? And yet to conceive of God any smaller seems a little ridiculous, doesn't it? Like trying to put God in a box. Oh, no, God's only over here. This is how big God is, just like that. Just as big as my theology can make him. Just as big as my beliefs can do it. That's the only size. That's how big God is. And yet C.S. Lewis comes along in these few statements and kind of blows that all apart. Every good thing anyone does anywhere in the world, no matter why they did it, is God's. So today I want to explore this concept. I'm going to come at it from a couple different ways. And I just want you to think about it. I'm not saying you need to believe this, but I want to challenge you to push you a little bit further to think a bit broader. Today I'm going to start the discussion with our spiritual forefathers, who I think also thought about this very concept. So let me start in the Old Testament. Can I just start with saying God does some really weird things sometimes? When I say weird, I mean weird. Like, I didn't see this coming at all weird. There's a story about this Egyptian slave named Hagar. Now, even me just saying she's Egyptian, it's not a matter of race. In the Bible, when you say Egyptian, it means she's pagan. It means she's not of the chosen people. She's not part of God's people. She's other than. So whenever you hear me say Egyptian, think pagan. And she's a slave. Basically, she is owned by somebody else. They can do whatever they want to her, whenever they want. There's zero consequences. There's no health and occupational safety nonsense. Nothing. She is property. You can take your car, drive it off the edge of a cliff. In those days, you can take your slave and throw him off the edge of the cliff. It's the same thing. So here's a pagan woman who basically has no value in this world whatsoever. Zero influence. And she's sitting in the desert, dying of thirst. And she meets God. And everything changes for her after that moment. And how she gets there is a bit complex, so I'll kind of give you the Coles notes. Hagar's owner, a Jewish woman, is barren. She can't have kids. And this is a big deal. So she did what was customary in her day. The Jewish woman gave her slave to her husband as kind of a wife. And then whatever progeny she'd have, if she had progeny, it was considered the Jewish woman's. And so Hagar went from being a slave to one day she's holding hands with the Jewish woman's husband. And they go to the marriage tent. And a little while later she realizes she's pregnant. She's carrying his baby. Now think about that. You went from being almost worth nothing. They could kill you in a whim. To suddenly, you have one of the most valuable things in the ancient Near East culture. Children. Her life went from like the lowest of the low to higher than I think she probably ever even imagined she could get. She's now a wife. Pregnant in a society where that's the most important thing ever. And her life starts to look better. And that's when the power dynamic between her and the Jewish woman kind of take a left turn. Because a Jewish woman's not super keen about the whole her coming up in status. She's like, yeah, I own you, just so you remember. And so she starts to put pressure on Hagar. Starts to make her life miserable. Just abuses her. And at first, Hagar can take it. She's like, hey, I started this thing off as a slave. A wife who's abused, even a second wife who's abused, is still better than a slave. But the Jewish lady just keeps ratcheting it up and ratcheting it up. And finally, Hagar just can't take it anymore. She's like, I'm done. I'm out of here. And so she runs away. And she runs towards Egypt. Now, I'm not sure, you know, a pregnant woman, however pregnant she was, I'm not sure what she's thinking. Can I walk, you know, 3 months to get back to my homeland? I'm not sure anyone's there that I know. I'm not sure what she's thinking, but that's what she does. She heads towards Egypt, to her homeland. And that's where she runs into God. Well, it's kind of like God in a person, so we're not really sure exactly how it works. Usually the Old Testament's not super clear about how it shows up. But anyway, she experiences God. And God says to her, the man who the boy inside of you is going to become, he's special. Can't you just see Hagar melting? Like, I'm going to have a son. She's been alone her whole life. She was probably sold as a slave when she was a child. She's never had family. She's only ever been property. And now, she has a son. So she did something that no other person in the biblical narrative ever did. No one Christian, no one Jewish, no one. Unprecedented. A pagan woman, a pagan slave woman, named God. And I know for us that's like oh, that's nice. I gave him a nickname. No, it doesn't work that way. In their culture, naming somebody means you have unbelievable influence over that person. In the Old Testament, when they change people's names, it just seems kind of confusing, like Jacob, Israel, like what's all that about? Abraham, Abram. It's fundamentally changing the person. That's what naming means. So Hagar, the pagan slave, names God. That shouldn't happen. She's a pagan. Like, God should just want nothing to do with her. The word that she names God, we translate it to say, God, the one who sees her. And after that moment, something changes. And the Egyptian slave Hagar, now second wife to a Jewish man, mother to a yet-to-be-born child, namer of God, goes back home. And that's when it gets a little bit weirder than that. Because you see, after she gets home, she has the baby, things get even worse. Like, that Jewish lady's just giving her the screws. And here's the problem. After Hagar has her baby, a little while later, that barren Jewish woman, she gets a baby as well. And now it's who gets the birthright. So firstborn usually gets the birthright. Secondborn is the Jewish lady's. Like, it's just one of those things where the lady's like, it's just not a good situation. And so in those day and age, you had a party if your baby made it past what they call weaning. So few babies made it past the weaning stage that they'd throw a big party like, hey, our baby made it. This is awesome. And on the day of the Jewish woman's baby's I finished weaning party, Hagar's son laughs at the Jewish boy. And that Jewish lady just loses her mind. Like, just loses it. She ends up taking, and again, remember, Hagar's baby is actually the Jewish woman's baby by law. She takes that baby, and Hagar kicks them out into the desert with a little bit of water. Essentially, she's trying to kill them. And not even trying, she is going to kill them. That's what's going on here. So Hagar finds herself in the desert once more. And it's worse this time. Now she has her son looking at her, crying because he's hungry. He's thirsty. And it's breaking her heart. Like, by herself, she probably saw herself with no value. Dying was just something that was going to happen to her. No big deal. But her son, to have him there with her in that moment. It just, I don't think she could, I think she snapped. She took her son and she placed him a little ways away, kind of behind a bush so she couldn't see him. She couldn't watch her own son die. It's in that moment that God comes back to her. God, the guy, the person, the entity that she named shows up in that moment. When everything is lost, she's just waiting to die. It's just a matter of when at this point. And God says, your son, I will make him into a great nation. Think about it. If progeny is the greatest currency in the ancient Near East, this is the best lottery in the history of the world. God just said, I will make all your dreams come true. This is the best possible scenario of any scenario. Your children, your great-grandchildren, your great-great-grandchildren, all of them, they will be there because I will make that happen. I will bless you and the children after you. Here is Hagar, a lowly pagan slave who started off with nothing, now the mother of an entire nation. I probably, like, when you win the lottery, like, I'm guessing she just has no, she's just like, what do I even say to that? And it's staggering for me too, and here's why. Because the child she blessed, or God blessed, Hagar's son, the nation that he would spawn, the nation created by God and blessed by God, that's the Muslim nation. You see, Hagar's son's name was Ishmael. And Ishmael is written about in the Islamic sacred scriptures as the forefather of Muhammad, their greatest religious figure. God blessed the Muslim nation. Story of Hagar, the Egyptian slave, mother of Ishmael, forefather of Muhammad, is a story of God creating a nation that has nothing to do with his chosen people, the Jews. It has nothing to do with the Christian nation. It seems our spiritual forefathers thought it was important to know, for us to know that they believed that God created the Muslim nation. And that's why this story kind of blows my mind. So let me talk about one more thing from the Bible. We're going to go into the earlier part, the New Testament. Have you ever had a moment where you read something in the Bible and you just wish Jesus was a little bit more clear? Like, seriously. You could have just said it, right? No, you had to, like... So if you ever have those moments where you're like, just wish Jesus would be, you know, kind of the way we learn the pedagogical approach, that's like, hey, this is what I want from you. I understand your pain. I feel it. I know last week I talked about not pursuing easy, so bear with me. But Jesus says something really interesting, or at least the gospel writer John records an interesting statement that Jesus says. And of course, it's a metaphor within a metaphor, so it's complex to try and tease it out. So let me do my very best to bring it out today. He says this, I have other sheep that do not belong to this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So the first problem I have is there's sheep metaphor all the way through this, so I had to call up my buddy who was like grew up as a sheep rancher and have him explain what all this stuff means and why sheep do the things that they do. So let me share with you kind of the things I learned. First, when he says a fold, it's like a pen. And back in those days, you had a pen, and it would help protect the sheep, and you had someone who kind of managed the pen. And you'd all bring your flock, so there's like 20 different flocks of sheep in the pen or in the fold. So, it's interesting. If you think about that from the metaphor of what Jesus is saying, he's talking to Christians. So he says, look around you, all the different groups of you in this pen, all you Christian groups, all the people who you're closest to, who believe the same things as you, who go to the same places, who are part of the same community. Yeah, there's more than that coming, by the way. If we could apply it to our present day age, we'd look around in all the Christians of the world, Protestants, Catholics, liberals, conservatives, Baptists, Uniteds. If all those Christians in the world got into a room and looked at each other, Jesus would say, yeah, there's still more people. So let me geek out here for a second and use my edumacation because I don't often get to use it. So bear with me for a moment. How many of you loved grammar back in school? I hated it, didn't listen to it at all, but I had to learn it when I got older. So what I want to do is I want to break down this sentence for you, okay? So first thing he says is, I have. I have is in a present tense. So you all remember that's right now, today. So he's saying, right in the present, I have people here who do not belong. Again, present. He's talking about this right now. Right in this moment, I have people who do not belong to this fold. But he says, I must bring them also. If you look at that bring them, it's in a verb tense called aorist. Anyone know an aorist tense? Proapolyptic futuristic aorist tense? That's technically what it is. What it means, just in case you don't know that, what it means is it's a past tense verb, but it's not like our simple past. Simple past would be, I went to the store. What it says is it's something that happened in the past, but it's such a sure event to happen that I'm actually going to say it in the future tense like it already happened. So it's like when you say to somebody, you know, before the race, I'm going to own you. That's kind of like this kind of tense. Yes, you haven't done it yet, but you're so confident that it's going to happen, you can say it like it's actually happened. So he says, I have these people here, and they don't, this is already happening. I'm going to call them, and it's such a certain thing, I'm going to say it in that way so you go, this is going to happen. And then he says something interesting. He says this, and they will listen to my voice. Now the reason I've told you the tenses is because that last piece is in a future tense. These people exist in a pen that aren't part of your pen, but they're part of a pen. I'm calling them. So just so you know, they're part of this thing. But they have yet to hear my voice. They're only going to hear my voice in the future. They don't even know my voice yet. They don't know me yet. But what you have to understand is they're still part of the group. They're already there, even though they don't know my name and they don't know my voice yet. Isn't that amazing? Sounds a lot like C.S. Lewis, doesn't it? So here's this soldier who worshipped Tash his whole life. He's in the pen. He never worshipped Aslan. But when he meets up with Aslan, or God, he recognizes his voice. And says, ah, that's what I was here for. All during that time, Aslan knew of his devotion and accepted it as his own, even though he'd never heard of Aslan before. Jesus talks about people who are not in the pen with the rest of the Christians like us, but yet they're part of this movement that Jesus is leading. But in some future time, they and God will have a little heart-to-heart. And they will realize that it was God they were serving all the time, even though they didn't even know his voice yet. Now, some of you might be thinking, I've just undermined the whole reason to be a Christian. Talking about God, being part of the Muslim nation, and there's other pens and stuff like that. And that's not what I'm trying to do, honestly. Because I actually love Christianity. I love it for two main reasons. First, the way of Jesus. It's pretty beautiful, isn't it? Look at our community this last month, or maybe this last year. We saved a village from starvation caused by parasites in Guatemala. We provided life-changing safety for families in Mexico. We've raised money to help eradicate the horrible implications of cancer. We've made phone calls, had powerful conversations, hugged, cried with the people in our lives. We had breakfast for homeless families and their kids. We've cleaned up the ravages of floods here in Calgary and now starting in High River. This way of Jesus, what we call taking water, That's why I want to be a Christian. Because it's beautiful, isn't it? And the second reason I follow Jesus is probably this one. This one's maybe going to feel a bit different for you, but just listen to me. I most likely follow Jesus because I was raised in a Christian home. God looks Christian to me. Do any of you honestly think that if you're born in the jungles of Papua New Guinea and you've never heard of Christianity or the Bible or the God of the Bible, any of that stuff, do you think your God would look like the Christian God? Or would it be expressed in the beliefs that you have? Do you think if you were raised in a devout Buddhist family in Tibet that God wouldn't be expressed in the teachings of Buddhism for you? Just like the soldier from C.S. Lewis's book who worshipped Tash all his life because he was raised in a culture that worshipped Tash. It's all he knew. For them, Aslan was the enemy. It's no wonder he worshipped Tash, even if, as Aslan said, Tash can't accept that devotion. I think God is profoundly colored for us by the way we were raised, by the influences in our lives. And yet, I think probably God is bigger than all that too. So now what? What do we do with all this? I think the first thing is I want to kind of chip away at this idea that we have God all figured out. That God is completely captured in the pages of the Bible. That Christian theology has completely defined God. We got him all figured out, or get all figured out. It's done. We can look at someone, when we think that way, we can look at someone from a different religion and a different way of life, a different upbringing. We can say, yeah, you're wrong. I think when you look at the biblical account and you talk about the different things God's done, can we not think that maybe God is bigger than that? God is more than our theology, more than the Bible, more than our conception of God. Just God is more, bigger. God's the God who, according to the Old Testament, blessed and created the Muslim nation. God is the God who have people serving God and they don't even know it yet. And if God is more, there are things in this world that God could be part of that are way outside of our understanding. Can we be open to that? God's bigger than that. God might show up in places we never expected. So today I want you to do a little bit of homework. I want you to go home, and I want you to discuss with people in your lives, wherever you're having a beer, lunch, whatever you're doing, talk to them about why you think you're a Christian. Just share it. Talk about what it means to you, why you did it, why this. And I want you to be aware that whatever the reason is, they're valid. But I want you to know them. And secondly, I want you to start looking at the people in your lives. And if God is bigger than all this, if God is like more, could we conceive that maybe God is working in other people's lives in ways we would never, ever guess? Could the thing that the people in our lives are trying to achieve and get to actually God, but just a God that looks different than the one I grew up with? And if we can do that, if we can see God behind all the good things in this world, I wonder if it maybe will just bring us together a little bit more. Not challenge our Christianity, but inspire us and the rest of our community to work together to make this world into a world that I think God might just want. So today let me leave you with that. Talk about why you're Christian. And start to think about maybe God is more than the religions we've been a part of. Maybe God is bigger than all that. Have a great week, everyone.